This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone on RN. I'm Loira Ferrascioli, and my guest today is Associate Professor Stephanie Collins from the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. Stephanie Collins has published a number of very interesting essays on the question of group agency. Her book came out last year, and it's called Group Duties: Their Existence and Their Implications for Individuals, with Oxford University Press. And her current project is entitled Organizations Wrongdoing, From Metaphysics to Practice, and it's funded by the Australia Research Council. Stephanie Collins, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Laura. It's really great to be here.
So to understand why this is such a fascinating topic, we need only stop and dissect some of the claims we make in political philosophy and political discourse more generally. We talk about organizations such as Coles and Woolworths underpaying their staff. We talk about big banks such as Commonwealth and Westpac exploiting their customers. And we seem to be talking about some kind of group or collective that does these things, and not just some particular individuals that engage in joint action. So these organizations seem to have a life of their own and engage in action that we can attribute back to the organization rather than the sum of the individuals. We also do that with states. We talk about Australia not taking its fair share of refugees. And when we say those things, we seem to be talking again about an entity that is distinct from the sum of individuals, of people who find themselves in the Australian territory. So, Stephanie, in light of that, am I right to think that we can make more progress on the question, or important questions in political philosophy, if we get a good understanding of what group agents are and what responsibilities they have and how they are distinct from individuals?
Absolutely. I think that's right. So one way to get into this is to think about the history of political philosophy. I mean, political philosophers for decades now have been kind of obsessed with what the right account of justice is. So does justice require that we reach, you know, net zero emissions by 2050? Does justice require equality of opportunity or equality of outcome for people within our society? Today's International Women's Day, so does justice require affirmative action for people of particular genders or races? These are all questions that political philosophers have engaged with at length. And yet, when we ask the question of to whom are we addressing these claims? So when we make demands of justice, when we say justice demands net zero emissions by 2050, for example, who are we making that claim to? It's typical to think we're making it to our state. Okay, so then what is the state? As you say, is it Scott Morrison? Is it the government? Is it all of Parliament? Does it include the citizens in some way? So I think that's sort of how this question of group agency relates to political philosophy. I think it's very important for moving forward on the issue of justice that we answer this question about who this agent is that we're addressing our demands of justice to. But then this question also matters for us in our capacity as ordinary citizens, right? So yeah, we pay taxes, we abide by laws, we have various kinds of demands and constraints on us in virtue of kind of what our state wants to do. And the question of the group agency of the state is partly a question of whether citizens are properly included within that group agent or what citizens' relation to that group agent is. And answering that question can tell us, I think, whether it's legitimate for us to bear some cost in virtue of the fact that our state bears certain obligations of justice.
Right. So before we can get into this question of whether the state is a group agent and who counts as a member of that group agent, I think it helps to get a better understanding of what a group agent is. How do we identify a group agent?
Different philosophers will give you different answers to this question, of course. The answer that I like is a group agent is any collection of more than one human individuals, where those individuals are, as I say, united under a rationally operated group level decision-making procedure. Now that's a mouthful, but we can think of it in very intuitive and basic terms. So take a really small group agent. Imagine that you and I are deciding where to go for lunch together. We might constitute a group agent vis-a-vis that decision. So our decision-making procedure is probably going to be conversation-based consensus, because that's sort of how you and I tend to operate. Those are the kinds of norms that we take ourselves to be subject to. So we've got this decision-making procedure. We're making a decision, a group-level decision about where to go for lunch on the basis of this procedure, which is conversation, hopefully leading to a consensus. And you and I are united under that procedure because we're committed to follow that procedure in making our group decision. And also we're united under it because we both have inputs into that procedure. It's not just that one of us is dictating to the other. If one of us was dictating to the other, then the second person wouldn't count as part of the agent of the decision. So that's a very small scale intuitive case. And then, of course, you can scale it up, right? So if you look at things like democratic states, their decision-making procedures are going to include elections, they're going to include judgments by judges, they're going to include parliamentary debate, they're going to include cabinet meetings. All of this is part of the group's decision-making procedure by which it can make decisions that are not equivalent to just a combination of individual decisions. And the easiest way to see that point, that the decisions are kind of distinct when they're at group level, is to think of cases of compromise. So we currently live under a coalition government, so obviously there's a lot of compromise that goes on between the Liberals and the Nationals to reach policy decisions. And that means that the decision that the government makes is not the decision that the Liberals would make. It's not the decision that the Nationals would make. Instead, it's this kind of amalgam. It's this kind of fusion compromise position between the two. So you get this group agent that makes a decision which is different than the decision that any of its members would make if they got to pick what the group was going to do. And the fact that you can get these unique different decisions, these decisions that are not what any member would decide, I think that gives us good reason to say this decision was made by the group, not just by each of the individuals.
Right. So we would also say that, for example, the University of Sydney is a group agent because it has decision-making procedures and staff can have an input into the decisions that it makes. It also has all sorts of boards and groups within the organization that are tasked with making all sorts of decisions. But so is that right? Am I right to think that an organization like, say, the University of Sydney is a group agent, whereas, say, feminists around the world won't count as a group agent because there is no decision-making procedure and an ability for members to have for feminists to have an input?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's going to be borderline cases where it can be sort of unclear whether something is really a group agent with a decision-making procedure or just some individuals who happen to share a goal like gender equality. But definitely University of Sydney is going to be on the group agent side of that divide. And as you said, feminists are going to be on the non-group agent side of that divide.
Okay, good. So let's focus on a group agent such as the University of Sydney, because as academics, we have a sense of how they work, organizations like universities work, and that might help to flesh mm-hmm. out exactly what we're talking about. So we have the University of Sydney, it's making decisions and it's acting in the world. It's doing things like educating the next generation of Australian citizens. And a skeptic might say, look, I can see that there is joint action on the part of academics, lecturers, tutors, support staff, security guards, etc. But we're just using the name of the organization, i.e. the University of Sydney, as shorthand for describing all these other actions on the part of individuals that come together to produce a certain outcome. So there is no agent that acts in the world. There are only individuals that engage in all sorts of actions. What do we gain by saying that the University of Sydney is a group agent that we can't already kind of describe already or already have with just talk of joint action, individuals acting at the same time in order to produce an outcome?
It's a really good question. One thing that we gain is persistence across time. So University of Sydney, I mean, the oldest, or at least one of the oldest universities in Australia, founded mid-19th century sometime. So it's a very old institution. None of the individuals who currently make up University of Sydney are that old, are as old as the university. And we might now, today, want to address the University of Sydney regarding things that it did 150 years ago. So let's take an example. Suppose 150 years ago, University of Sydney was not very great at admitting Indigenous students. I'm going to assume that's probably true. Today, we can, you know, we might want to ask for an apology from University of Sydney. We might want to ask that University of Sydney engages in various sort of reparative actions to improve the status of Indigenous students within the university. And it's very hard to make sense of that as being grounded in the wrong that it did 150 years ago if we don't view University of Sydney as this thing that has persisted through all these changes in membership. If University of Sydney is just the current people who happen to operate its decision-making procedure, then they can all say, well, we weren't there 150 years ago. Why are we being asked to apologize for this? So that's one thing. Another thing that we get is we get to fill these things that philosophers call responsibility gaps. So this is relevant to a case study that I'm looking at for my current research project, which is the Banking Royal Commission. So as you might recall, about 2 years ago now, the Royal Commission into sort of mispractice in the banking and finance industry found that many banks and financial institutions within Australia were operating with a really strong culture of greed, and they were sort of taking money from customers. If you recall, it was customers who had died were still being charged fees and so on. And the interesting thing about this case is that you look at all the individuals involved and you say, well, you know, they had certain incentives within their employment structure to do these actions. Are we going to blame particular home loan advisors? Are we going to blame even particular bank managers? They're just operating within the system where they're kind of being told, look, this is what you should do. And I'm not saying the individuals are entirely off the hook, but the wrong that the banks do seem to be somehow more than the sum of the wrong that the individuals do, because it's this culture of greed that's driving these institutions that kind of leads these individuals down this path of enacting these bad policies. So we get this gap between the amount of blame and sort of anger that we want to direct at the organization and the amount of blame that we think we can reasonably attribute to, you know, these poor home loan advisors who were sort of just trying to do their job. And so if we say, well, okay, Westpac is now something that can be blameworthy, then we have a place to direct that blame, including in criminal law by sort of holding the organization itself criminally responsible.
You're listening to ABCRN. This is the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Luara Ferrascioli. And my guest is Dr. Stephanie Collins, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University. And her most recent book is called Group Duties, Their Existence and the Implications for Individuals, published with Oxford University Press. Let's now move to the question of whether states can be group agents, especially because we started this conversation talking about duties of justice. We tend to think that those duties fall on states. So first of all, are states group agents? And what's the best way to understand states as group agents? What's the best account to make sense of the idea that states are group agents?
States are absolutely group agents. I mean, there are some questions to be asked about failed states. You know, are the Syrian rebels really properly understood as part of the Syrian state? Probably not. So there are these sort of hard borderline cases. But if we look at a fairly stable state like Australia, it's definitely going to be a group agent. And here we can go back to the kinds of points I was making before. Australia makes decisions that are different from the sum of each individual's decision, insofar as it's a compromise decision or it's a decision that goes with the majority but not with everybody. And yet all members of Australia do have inputs into that decision. So Australia, importantly on this view, isn't some sort of strange, ghostly fiction. This is a worry that a lot of people have about group agency, sort of, where are these group agents when we look out in the world and we can't see them anywhere? There's no physical, material life to them. And my answer to that is, well, they are constituted by the members, sort of physically and materially speaking. And they make these decisions that are different from the members' decisions. So that kind of underpinning by members is very important, even though the group agent is an extra thing in the world. So this is just analogous to how, you know, my cells make me up, and yet I'm kind of an extra thing in the world. I'm, in some sense, more than the sum of my cells, insofar as my decisions are not the decisions of my cells. So that's how the kind of membership state relation works.
Good. But do we get this strange implication then that, for example, in the case of Australia, we have many citizens that are not members of the group agent because, say, they don't yet have the right to vote, say, adolescents, children. But then at the same time, we have non-citizens, so people who are residing in the territory, don't have political rights, but, you know, join protests, write petitions, knock on the door of their local MPs. Do we then end up including people who do not count as part of the citizenry? Is that awkward or is that okay? It's just that we're so used to thinking of the citizens as the members of the state that acts.
Yeah, this is a really good point. So it's very important that for these purposes, we're talking about the state as a group agent and we're talking about members as the people whose agency is in some way bound up with the state's agency. And those members might not be the people who we want to count as members for other purposes. So if we think of children, for example, of course, the state has very important obligations to its citizens who are children. And so in that sense of the state having particular obligations to these children, those children are going to be members. But there's another sense in which the children are not members, which is the sense of being implicated in the state's agency. I think that's the right result for people who don't have these kinds of inputs into Australia's decision making. Now, the other group you asked about was people like you and I, actually. So I'm a New Zealander. I don't have the right to vote in Australia. I'm not yet a citizen. But I attend protests, I sign petitions, so on and so forth. In my view, I do count as a member because those kinds of inputs that I'm having are licensed by the state's procedure. Now, it could be that the state sort of didn't want these inputs from me. So here we might think about the influence of foreign media on elections, for example. Those kind of entities, you know, foreign media outlets have influence over what the state decides because they really influence citizens. But that kind of influence isn't asked for by the procedure, isn't the decision-making procedure doesn't encourage it. So it's not going to be the kind of input that's going to make you a member. Now, again, just as there's vagueness in what counts as a group agent or not, there is going to be vagueness in membership. And to go back to the analogy of me and my cells, you might think a hair on my head is part of me. But then we just take that hair off my head and now I'm holding it in my hand. Is it still a part of me? Well, we want to say no. Okay, so what about the fact that my skin is kind of constantly coming off my body in the form of dust, right? How are we dealing with that? So there's vagueness around the boundaries of all agents, physically kind of speaking in the individual case, and kind of decision-wise speaking in the group case. So there is going to be vagueness. That doesn't worry me, though. I think almost all interesting philosophical concepts have vague boundaries, and membership in a group agent is one of them.
Would another reason to prefer an account that includes the citizens be the fact that then it's easier to talk about duties? And by that, I mean, if states have duties, we can tell some story about how those duties go from the state to individuals.
I would want to be careful here about the direction of the argument. So I wouldn't be inclined to say that we should view citizens as part of the group agent that is the state because it allows us to place duties on citizens. I think that that distribution of duties is an upshot. It's a result of the fact that, on my view at least, citizens are included within the state. But it's definitely true that if we take the view that citizens are included within the state as an agent, then on my view, it follows that every time the state has a duty, citizens have some duty or other. And that duty might just be kind of trusting reasonably that the state is doing, that other parts of the state, that is, are doing what they should. But it might also mean paying taxes and so on and so forth. So I do think if you include citizens within the state, then whenever the state has a duty, that's going to have some kind of implications for citizens, even though it might be kind of a weak implication in terms of following the news to check that, as far as you can reasonably tell, given security restrictions and so on, that the state is doing what it should, or whether it goes so far as, you know, paying taxes and so on.
You say that it's an upshot of your way of thinking about states as group agents. But again, if we go back to how people talk about states, I think most people assume that there is a duty that falls on the individual as a result of their membership in the state, right? So now when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about the fact that in order to discharge our obligations around climate change, we'll have to bear some costs as citizens. We are talking about the duties of individuals are somehow coming from the state rather than going straight into the individuals without going via the state.
Absolutely, that's right. And I think it's a nice feature of my view that my view vindicates or accords with this everyday way of talking where, okay, when Australia has a duty, that must mean Australians have some kind of duty, which might just mean obeying the laws that Australia passes in order to discharge its duty. I think it's a nice feature of my view that it vindicates that kind of picture. But I would worry about a kind of circularity if I said, oh, this must be true just because it's the way we talk. There's the way that we talk, and then the job of philosophers is to come up with a theory that can vindicate that, where that theory is kind of independently motivated. And it's good that the theory vindicates the everyday talk. But in the case of group agency, I think that the theory that says that citizens are included is motivated independently and sufficiently, even without this kind of everyday thought that, yeah, when Australia has duties, Australians have duties.
I think that your answers to the questions all seem quite intuitive and in line with how we talk in public discourse, but also it seems to give us very good resources to answer other important questions in political philosophy, such as questions around who has duties of justice, are the people self-determining, why does that matter, what rights come with self-determination. So I think this is a very good way of thinking about group agents and the state as a group agent. But now, before we finish our discussion, I wanted to pick your brain on something that is also close to our hearts, which is the position of women in philosophy. Today is International Women's Day, as you mentioned. And I was wondering if you think that things have improved for women in the profession, or whether you think we haven't made much progress since we both started our PhDs in philosophy over 10 years ago.
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I think in the last 10 years, there has been progress. I think it's much more common now to see people pressing for there to be more women on reading lists in undergraduate curricula in philosophy, for people to be very concerned about gender representation at conferences. So there's now sort of campaigns against conferences that have no women on the speaker list. And I think these sorts of campaigns definitely have increased in their visibility and in their results over the last 10 years. So that's all good. But we do also have some steps left to take in philosophy. The thing about philosophy, like a lot of professions, is that there's this pipeline from undergraduate to postgraduate to being a lecturer, senior lecturer, associate professor, da-da-da. You go through this career path. And I think we're starting to see changes at the undergraduate and postgraduate level through the kinds of measures that I just described. But if we look at the professor level in philosophy, it's still true that there are far fewer women professors than man professors in philosophy. And that's not unique to philosophy. It's common across a lot of academic disciplines. But I think one cause of that is the expectations that our society has around things like care work, so caring for young children and caring for elderly relatives, often falls to women as just a matter of expectation. And then that means that a lot of women's sort of career paths take a different turn at around that kind of, you know, level that you and I are both at in our careers right now, which is this sort of, you know, senior lecturer kind of level. And that, I think addressing that is probably going to be necessary to see a level of equality between men and women at the professorial level.
So many educated women leave the decision to have children to their 30s, right? More and more of our cohort of educated women have made that decision. But when it comes to an academic career, that really is the time where you build your career. That's the time where you take the steps required to, say, as you say, become a professor. So it seems really hard for women who want to have a family to take all the steps that are required to make it all the way to professorship, precisely because that's also the time where they are looking after young children. So you're hopeful that things are going to improve, but it's hard to come up with solutions given how entrenched this whole system is of getting your first job, building yourself up all the way to professor.
Exactly. I'm hopeful. I think things like changes around paid parental leave will make a difference. I also think if academia in general and philosophy in particular had a better culture of work-life balance, then that would improve things. Academics are often expected to go to numerous overseas conferences per year to showcase their research and all this kind of thing. And that's all to the good of research and collaboration. But if you're, you know, breastfeeding or what have you, that's really a tough demand to place on a person. So I think laws around things like parental leave and also expectations within the discipline around things like, you know, giving a conference presentation online rather than in person for an international conference. And then you can do it while your baby's sitting right there from just next to your computer. These kinds of informal expectations within the discipline, I think, also will make a difference. And so I'm hopeful that those kinds of changes will have some kind of effect. But I think we haven't seen them as much as we could have so far.
Good. Well, on that note, as someone who is on maternity leave and has a baby that needs breastfeeding, I'll leave you there. Stephanie Collins, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks very much, Laura. It's been fun.
That was Stephanie Collins, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University, talking to us from Melbourne. This was ABCRN, The Philosopher's Zone. I'm Luara Fascioli. Thanks for listening.